Okay, hi. Is this on? Okay, good. Good evening. I want to welcome everybody to tonight's program, Our Power to Help the Poor. Joining us today is Peter Singer, professor of bioethics at Princeton University, who I will be introducing in a moment. My name is Deborah Satz, and I'm a professor of philosophy and director of the McCoy Family Center for Ethics and Society at Stanford. I'd also like to acknowledge Human Rights Watch and Books Incorporated, who are co-sponsoring tonight's event. A quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. And if you're interested, you should consult the Council's website for more information. When you can't attend a program, unlike all of you, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming online audio. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. And today's program is being recorded for It's Your World, and we thank our audio engineer, John Trinidad. Finally, please locate the blue question cards that have been placed on your chairs, and you should write down your questions now if you already have any, but as you listen to the talk for Professor Singer, and then hand them to Council staff members who will be collecting them. And please also turn off your cell phones and anything else that might interrupt our program. Okay, it's my distinct honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Peter Singer is the Ira DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton's University Center for Human Values and the Laureate Professor at the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics at the University of Melbourne. A philosopher and an ethicist, he was named one of the most influential people in the world by Time magazine. He's the author of over 40 books, including Practical Ethics, Animal Liberation, The Ethics of What We Eat, and One World. In addition to his work in ethics and animal rights, Peter Singer is well known for his important contributions to the issue of global poverty. In our world, 1 billion people are destitute. They live on less than a dollar a day. They're not imprisoned in destitution because of their crimes. They're imprisoned in destitution despite their innocence. Another 1.5 billion live only slightly better on less than $2 a day. They too are imprisoned in poverty despite their innocence. And that's how, on our planet, 40% of the world's population lives. In his article, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, which was published in 1972, Peter Singer argued that the fact that some people live in abundance while others starve is morally indefensible. The essay is one of the most influential, and to my mind, one of the best, articles in contemporary moral philosophy. His newest book, which he's here to talk about, The Life You Can Save, discusses this idea in depth. So, here to discuss our responsibilities to the world's poor, please join me in welcoming Peter Singer.
Thank you very much, Deborah, for that generous introduction. And, of course, thank you to the World Affairs Council of Northern California for making this event possible and giving me the opportunity to talk to you about the subject of the book. That subject is, as Deborah said, one that I've been working on for a very long time, back at least to the early 70s when I wrote that original article. I wrote that at the time because there was a crisis going on in what was then East Pakistan, what is now Bangladesh. The Pakistani army had been repressing a movement for independence for East Pakistan, and about 9 million refugees had fled across the border into India. India at the time was a much poorer country than it is today. It's still not a wealthy country. And the burden of feeding and sheltering 9 million refugees was really just beyond it. But although the developed world, the rich nations, gave some assistance, they were not giving nearly enough to deal with that problem. And that was the kind of trigger that made me ask, well, what are our obligations here? Is it okay for us to be living a very comfortable life, spending money on all sorts of things that are by no stretch of the imagination necessities, while there are 9 million people who have no security that they will be able to continue to live, just to eat and have shelter? So I wrote that article, which begins with a famous little thought, now famous little thought experiment, which I've told often, but which I'll tell you again because I think it sets up the questions of what our obligations are. So I ask you to imagine that you're walking across a park where there's a shallow pond, something that you know is shallow because you've seen kids playing in it, perhaps on a hot day, and you see a small child floundering about in the water, apparently in danger of drowning. So you look around for the parents or the carer for the child, but you don't see anyone. And you realize that it looks like it's up to you. This child could drown, and you seem to be the only person around who could save the child. As you're about to rush into the pond to save the child, it occurs to you that this morning you put on your new pair of shoes for which you paid a lot of money, and they're going to get ruined if you rush into this shallow pond. So I ask the reader then, is this a reason, is this a justification for not rescuing the child? If you were to say, well, I don't want to ruin my shoes, I don't want to have to pay a lot of money again for another pair of shoes like them, because I really like them, so I'll just walk on by. I'll just go on with my business, whatever I was setting out to do, and forget about the child. Now, I think pretty well everyone agrees that that would be wrong, that people will say something like, you can't weigh up a child's life against a pair of shoes, even if they're Jimmy Choo or whatever upmarket brand of shoes you favour, they still don't count as much as a child's life. So I think that's right. I hope that that's what you all think. And in fact, it's not just wrong, but it's something almost monstrous to think about not rescuing the child because you'd ruin your shoes. But now let's step back to the situation, either the situation that the rich nations were in at the time of the Bangladesh crisis in 1971, or it's not so different in the world today, because as Deborah mentioned in her introduction, we have a billion or so people who really are destitute, and the result of that is that their lives are also imperiled. Not, of course, that all of those billion are going to die from poverty, but a significant number of them do die every year. The United Nations Fund for Children, UNICEF, tells us that nearly 10 million children die every year from avoidable poverty-related causes. They die from diseases that we don't die from because we can get medical treatment. Diseases as simple as diarrhea can be fatal if you can't get any kind of health care, any kind of treatment for it. Diseases like measles that we are immunized against, many of them are not, and that's also a killer. Diseases like malaria, which we can protect ourselves against in various ways with repellents or clothing, perhaps with bed nets when we sleep, and which we can treat if we are unfortunate enough to get, they often don't have the bed nets to protect themselves against, and they can't afford the drugs to help them if they get it. So there's those sorts of things. Then there's things like not having safe drinking water, which obviously is likely to cause the diarrhea that will kill some of those kids. And not having sanitation, again, will cause diseases to spread. And for some people, also, it's simply not getting enough calories, not getting an adequate diet. That's a minority of these 10 million deaths, but it is certainly a part of it as well. So even if there's not a big present emergency, as there was in Bangladesh at that time, as there has been on various occasions, the Asian tsunami or the floods in Burma more recently, nevertheless, we are every day in a situation in which lives are being lost, the lives of innocent children are being lost because of a simple lack of the resources to provide things which we know will save life. So that's why, as I say, I think the situation we're in does have parallels with the situation of the child in the pond. And it's not at all far-fetched to think that the cost of a pair of shoes, anyway a pair of upmarket brand of shoes, could be enough to save the lives of one of these children. In fact, some of the things that save lives are extremely cheap. The cost of the treatment for diarrhea, what's called oral rehydration therapy, is actually, you measure in cents rather than dollars. It's less than a dollar to provide. Of course, you have to actually have the clinics in the right places where the people need it, or else you have to provide the treatment in the villages and give people a bit of education and training about how to use it. So even if the cost of the contents of the treatment themselves are only a few cents, the cost of getting the treatment where it's needed and saving lives with it is no doubt dollars rather than cents. The cost of a bed net, you might have heard, there's been a bit of a campaign about it that I think the NBA has been involved in. The cost of a bed net is about $10, but not every bed net saves a life. Obviously, there are children who survived in areas with malaria before there were bed nets, so you may have to distribute quite a few bed nets to know that you've saved a life, but still, if you get up to distributing 20 or 30 bed nets, $200 or $300, the calculations that I've seen suggest that that might well be enough to save a life. So we're not talking about large sums here, and we can make that difference. The question then is, if we agree that you would be doing something clearly wrong, seriously wrong, if you did not rush into the pond and save the child, ruining your shoes, can we deny that we're doing something seriously wrong if we do nothing to save any of these children who are in such need in the world? And, I have to add here, and we also have enough to do that. So I'm not perhaps addressing absolutely everyone, even in this nation. There are families who are struggling to put enough food on the table, or perhaps more realistically, to pay the rent or to meet the mortgage payments at the present economic downturn. And I'm not really addressing people in that situation. But the rest of us, I think, do have enough to spare to make a real difference. We do spend money on luxuries, things we don't need. In the book, actually, I use this example. How many of you buy bottled water? Well, it's a luxury. You have no need to buy bottled water. The water on the tap here, out of the tap, is safe to drink. San Francisco, in fact, actually has particularly good water. I've been drinking it. Yes, this bottle's a convenient way of getting water if you haven't thought ahead when you go out and there's nothing there, but you don't really need to pay for water. You don't need to pay for a whole lot of other things, ranging from that rather minor expenditure upwards. And anybody who's doing that has some level of luxury that is not available to those in extreme poverty. In fact, the cost of the bottle of water might be, as Deborah was saying, about what a billion people have to live on for an entire day, enough to feed their family. Another link in the chain that I have to make, of course, is to say that there are ways in which we can get that money to the people who need it. Or let me rephrase that, because it's not a question of getting the money. It's not that I want to say, okay, so instead of spending a dollar or two on the water, that dollar or two will go to people who need it. No, what I mean is it will go to agencies that will provide some of the things that I've referred to. That is, it will provide bed nets, or it will provide oral rehydration therapy against diarrhea, or it will set up basic health clinics in rural areas. It will provide immunization against measles, or, because lack of a good diet is part of it, maybe it will provide assistance to farmers. It will provide them improved seeds that can yield more or grow in times of low rainfall, provide them with education in better farming techniques, provide them with fertilizers, maybe to get them better crops so that they can produce more, and then once they've done that, they can buy their own fertilizers. Maybe it will help them to set up little cottage industries, cooperative industries. Maybe it will advance them microcredit loans so that they can start a small business and better support their family. All of those things are things that it's within our power to do by donating to some of the agencies that are doing that work. And I think there are a lot of agencies that do that. I talk about a number of them in the book. I've also set up a website with the same title as the book, same address, thelifeyoucansave.com, and that has further information, including a list of organizations that I believe are genuine organizations, bona fide, where you don't have to worry that your money is going to get siphoned off by the bureaucrats or given to repressive, corrupt governments or anything of that sort. It is going to get to the people who need it. So we have that capacity, as I was saying, to do something about this. And I think that that's, you know, that's the core of the argument, really, that if we have the moral obligation to save the toddler in the pond, we have the moral obligation to do something about this. There's, of course, a lot more that needs to be said. There are a number of objections that I discuss in the book. There are a lot of questions about why don't we do it, psychological questions about what are the barriers to doing it, some of those are certainly worth discussing and thinking about how we can set up different kinds of culture which encourages people to give more and to do more. I think all of those issues are things that we do need to talk about. Let me talk a little bit perhaps about trying to change the culture so that more people do it. I mean, maybe I've convinced you that we all should do it, but how can we actually produce a larger change? You can produce an individual change yourself, and you can make a difference to a family or maybe even a village, depending on your means, but you can't solve the problem. We need to involve people in this country, particularly as the largest of the rich nations, but in the affluent world generally. We need to involve people in this effort. And I think part of the problem is that we don't really have enough focus on the world as a whole, and particularly on the developing world. And that's why the work of the World Affairs Council is really important, and I'm sure those of you who are members of it and are involved with it are people who already have that awareness and that larger focus. But generally, I think it is lacking in this country. We tend to look inward. I was talking to some high school students who were here actually just before, and one of them was saying about how the education was someone who'd come to this country, an immigrant. The education was very much about America and American history, was what people learn in high school, not very much really about the world as a whole. And I've noticed that too as I'm an immigrant too, I guess. As you can tell from the funny way I speak, I'm an Australian. And coming here from Australia 10 years ago, I've certainly noticed that there's less focus on the world as a whole in the media here than there is in Australia. If you watch television news or read the newspapers, it's true, it's a smaller country. You could say, well, there's less going on anyway. They've got to talk about something else. Really, I think that unless there's some particular problem that concerns us, unless we've gone to war with a country or something of that sort, a lot of countries just drop out of the news, don't really feature, and that's very often true of, say, the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. And we have to try and do something about that. We have to try and change that so that we're more aware of the rest of the world and more aware of our ability to help them. We also, I think, have to try and expose the widespread myth that Americans still seem to believe that this is the most generous nation in the world as far as overseas foreign aid is concerned, and that it's bearing a lot of the burden of helping the poor nations. I quote some interesting figures in the book about what Americans say on this question when they're asked about it. They always wildly, well, not always, not everybody, but the majority of Americans wildly overestimate how much our country spends on foreign aid. And then they tell you that we spend too much. A lot of people will say, well, yeah, we should cut back. So you get people, you ask people something like, well, how much of the federal budget, now we're talking about government spending, how much of the federal budget do you think is spent on foreign aid? And in a number of different surveys, answers tended to vary from 10% to 20% of the federal budget. You then ask people, well, is this too much or about right or whatever? They say, oh, it's too much. All right, so you say, well, how much of the federal budget do you think should go on foreign aid? And the answers then vary between 5 and 10%. 5 and 10% of the federal budget. These people who say we give too much should go on foreign aid. Actually, the amount of the federal budget that goes on foreign aid is less than 1%. So on the one hand, they're saying we're giving too much. On the other hand, they're saying we should give 5 to 10 times as much as we give now. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And what it suggests is that if people better understood how little of the federal budget goes on foreign aid, then they would have a better understanding of why people might be saying we could be doing more for the poor countries of the world. Since we've been hearing a lot of big figures lately in terms of the stimulus, you might be interesting to have not just a percentage but an actual figure. For the last year for which I've got statistics, I think it's 2007, the US gave $22 billion in foreign aid. As you know, President Obama recently signed a stimulus package for $787 billion, I think, wasn't it? It certainly dwarfs the $22 billion. I'm not sure what the defense budget is up around now. Is it $500 billion or something around that, I think. So it's really quite a small proportion of what we're doing. Now, a lot of Americans will say, ah, yes, but, you know, we're a nation that believes in small government, low taxes, and we make up for the fact that our government doesn't do so much by giving more privately. Well, Americans do give a lot of private charity, but actually very little of it goes overseas. The largest segment of it by far goes to churches, synagogues, mosques, whatever. And of that, most of it goes for maintaining the fabric of the buildings or paying the salaries of the people who work for them. Only a small fraction of that actually goes overseas. And donations directly to overseas organizations like CARE or World Vision or Children International or Oxfam America is quite a small percentage of the philanthropy that we give. So even if you add that in, it doesn't really fundamentally change the picture. We're still giving only about a third as much as a percentage of our gross national income as the leading nations, as nations like Sweden or Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, tend to give about three times as much, sometimes even four times as much as we give, even when you add in, well, when you add in private philanthropy, three times as much rather than four times as much. But still, it's not a good record. So we can do a lot more. How can we change this culture? One of the things that I'm trying to do in the book, of course, and in speaking to you now and doing the publicity tour for the book that I started on Monday and will be doing for the next 3 weeks, is I'm trying to get people to have more of a discussion about this and to be more open about the giving that they do. Because one of the things that psychologists have shown is that people are more ready to help when they see that other people are helping. we still very much are, you know, looking around at what others do before we make our own decisions. And if we can be more public about our giving, I think that will help to change the culture. Also, I think we need to be more public about people who are very wealthy and who are not giving. Deborah and I were just talking beforehand about some of the billionaires that we have around this area. Larry Ellison, for example, who has a huge yacht and I think a house that he put on the market for $63 million. I talk in the book about Paul Allen, who lives, I think, up in the northwest, up around Seattle. He happened to have the good fortune, those who don't know who Paul Allen is, he happened to have the good fortune to have a schoolmate called Bill Gates, and together they decided to found a little software company, which did pretty well. Paul Allen pulled out quite a few years ago, but he held on to a lot of his Microsoft stock, and I guess it's probably fallen a bit in the last few months, but he still has a fortune that would be well over $10 billion. He also has a huge yacht. I think he and Larry Ellison at one stage were competing for whose is the biggest. You know, he hasn't really given a lot. In comparison to Bill Gates, he's been very stingy, and a lot of his charity has been very local, focused on the things like, I think, a kind of air and space museum or something in the Pacific Northwest, those sorts of things that he's interested in. So I think we ought to hold people to public standards, which Gates and Warren Buffett and a number of others have, I think, met in terms of the amount of their money that they've given. But we ought really to try and say, look, it's a responsibility, if you have such wealth, to share it and to share it with some of the poorest people, not only the particular causes that are interest you or that happen to be near where you live. So so that's one way of trying to change the culture. I'll also just mention one more that I was actually talking about with Michael Krasny on the forum today, and that's to try to allow inertia to work in the right way. So if you take a slightly different area, giving organs, should you ever end up tragically brain dead as a result of an accident, the eligibility to give your organs to somebody who could benefit from them and whose life you could save. In Germany, about 12% of the population is eligible to have their organs removed, legally eligible, if they're in such an accident. In neighbouring Austria, which is a country with a similar kind of culture, speaks the same language, that figure is 99.9%. What's the difference? Well, the difference is very simple. In Germany, if you want to be an organ donor, you have to go and sign a piece of paper to say you want to be an organ donor. In Austria, if you want to not be an organ donor, you have to go and sign a piece of paper that says you don't want to be an organ donor. Both systems protect freedom of choice. You still have a complete right to choose. It's not difficult to choose in either way. But that, you know, human inertia, I think we've all experienced, oh yeah, of course I believe in being an organ donor, you know, I'll sign that thing when I get around to it, you know, and then we don't get around to it. So that's the kind of thing that I think we need, and I would like to see some institutions actually using that so that if you're employed by a university or a corporation, something like that, you always get a lot of papers to sign, things like that. So I'd like to see a paper that says it's our policy to donate, let's say, 0.5%, I don't know what the figure might be, could be 0.25%, could be 1%, depending what you think will work, of your salary to organizations that are working for the world's poorest people. If you don't want us to do this, just tick this box. Okay. I mean, I think something as simple as that would make a sizable difference to the amount that was donated. Partly because, you know, it's there, it's suggested, and it becomes the default, it becomes the norm. People might talk about it a bit more if it was there. So I'd like to see us thinking that way and trying to use these strategies, these devices, in order to make it the normal thing for us to contribute to the world's poor rather than the exception. I think if we were to do something like that, if we were to up the amount that we give, we really could end this situation that Deborah described in introducing me, where you have a billion or so people living in extreme poverty and maybe another couple of billion living in severe, though not quite so desperate, poverty. I think that that's doable. Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia University economist, did a study for the United Nations a couple of years ago. He was focusing on the people in extreme poverty. He was actually studying what it would take to meet the Millennium Development Goals. You might remember, some of you, in the year 2000, the leaders of the world's nations came to New York, about 180 of them, and they signed a statement that by 2015, we're more than halfway there now, by 2015 we would reduce by half, cut in half, the proportion of the world's population living in extreme poverty. They said that by the year 2015 we would cut in half the proportion of the world's population without safe drinking water. They said they would ensure that every child could get at least an elementary school education. And there were a number of other goals, cutting back on the rate of HIV, AIDS infection, other diseases. Sachs calculated how much this would cost. Now, there's a certain amount of flexibility, I guess, in guessing, estimating in these calculations, but he thought it would be about $189 billion a year to achieve it, from the whole world, not just from the United States. That's not such a vast amount. As I said, it's, we've got that $787 billion economic stimulus. You might say, well, we need that. We have to stimulate the economy. This country alone spends $116 billion a year on alcohol. So, that's more than our share, right? If it's $189 billion needed from the world as a whole, the U.S. economy as a share of the economy, the economies of the affluent world all added together, is about a third. So you might say that our share would be something like $63 billion, only about half of what we spend on alcohol alone. So it's doable, at least. Meeting the Millennium Development Goals is doable. And if we don't meet them, and at the moment I'd have to say we're not really on track to meet them, then that's something that we have failed to do, not because the task was impossible or too difficult, but because we didn't have the will to do it and we didn't have the will to put the resources into it. But I think we can do it, and I hope that we will do it and that we will eventually see the end of this situation where there is such widespread extreme poverty, which is really a condition incompatible with the basic minimum for a decent human life. It may always occur in some places in the world. There may always be a repressive government, a civil war, a flood, which puts some people in these situations. But it doesn't have to be the case that there's more than a billion people in the world living a life where they are struggling to provide even for their basic necessities, let alone the other things that we all just take for granted as part of what a decent life involves. So thank you very much for listening. I'll be looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
There are a lot of questions, so I'm going to try to group them together a little bit. And the first set of questions really presses on the individual-to-individual aspect of your view and asks about institutions, and in particular, corrupt governments. You've already mentioned civil wars, the way that institutions mediate a lot of our obligations to others, and what do we do in the context of a world in which people are divided into states, and states have some responsibilities or irresponsibilities to combat poverty.
Okay, that's a good set of questions. It's certainly true that states play a major role in various ways. Sometimes they can play a good role. Those nations like Sweden and Norway that I mentioned that give a lot of aid tend to give it mostly through the state. The citizens accept that it's reasonable for the government to tax them to give foreign aid, and their foreign aid departments are generally free of political motivation. So they actually give to some of the poorest nations, and they have people out there in the fields trying to make sure that their giving is effective. We don't do that as well. If you look at the nations that our aid goes to, it is more politically directed. So the number one recipient of US aid at the moment is Iraq. Iraq is not the poorest nation by far. In fact, it's got the world's third largest oil reserves. So it really has potential wealth. But clearly it is of great political significance to us, has been for some years, to stabilize it to be able to claim some sort of victory in the war we've been waging there. The next nation is Afghanistan, similar sort of reasons, though it is genuinely a poor nation. And the third is Egypt, which is a partner in the Middle East peace process, really, not a particularly poor nation. And the poorest nations of the world don't figure very largely on that list. One of the largest, perhaps the largest of all the Latin American nations, for example, is Colombia. Colombia is not the poorest of the Latin American nations, but it's significant to us because of its role in producing cocaine and the drug trade, and a lot of that aid is actually to suppress the drug traffic. So USAID tends to be more politically motivated, and I think it does less good dollar for dollar than the aid of some other countries. But now, there is the question of the recipient countries' governments. That's important. And a lot of people say, well, how can you help these countries when they're being run by repressive and corrupt governments? And tragically, it's true that sometimes we really can't do a lot. I suppose the obvious example at the moment is Zimbabwe. The best way to help the people of Zimbabwe would be to get rid of Robert Mugabe. But I'm not suggesting that we go in there and do that. I think that would not lead to a good response, because there's this kind of white colonialist history that they would have, and I don't think it would work very well. If the South Africans were to take steps to get rid of Mugabe, that might work rather better, but doesn't seem like they're about to do that at the moment. So maybe sometimes you have to say, look, we can't really work in this country. The government is too repressive. It's not really letting us even go directly in to help the people. Burma may be another example of that at the time. So, then we just have to work somewhere else. It's tragic. It's tragic for those people, some of whom will become refugees, as a substantial number of Zimbabweans have, and go elsewhere, and we can help them when they cross the border, but it's still tragic. But we have, at least at the moment, we have a lot of governments that are supportive of good governance and supportive of programs to help their own people and the poor, and those are the ones that we should be helping to show that that works and that that pays off. And even some countries where you couldn't say the government is really a good government, but the government may be a government that leaves a lot of its people pretty well alone and allows aid organizations to go in and help those people directly. So you can then go in and help on the village level. You don't have to actually give your money to the government. You can go in there and you say, well, you don't have safe drinking water here. The women of this village I see are walking 2 hours a day just to bring water to their homes, and that's not safe water. It's polluted from a polluted river. But there are aquifers under the rock, and we can bring in equipment that we can drill through, and we can provide you with a well. So the government may say, fine, if you want to do that, go ahead. And you can just do it. And so you do help that village. You help the women who don't have to spend 2 hours a day carrying water. You help the children who don't get diarrhea. You can set up a lot of good things in that way. So we don't always have to go through the repressive and corrupt governments, I guess, and we need to look for the places where we can be effective in helping.
Okay, another set of institutions that somebody raises a question about are NGOs, and wonders whether NGOs are as efficient as they might be. There are stories about large overheads, huge salaries, not that much aid going to do the benefit that a donor might want the aid to be going to.
Yeah. There are such stories, and there are people, this is quite a widespread belief, so it's good that it's aired and should get discussed. I'm not denying that there are aid organizations or purported aid organizations that don't do a good job. But the kind of figures that I get quoted and have been getting quoted to me in the last couple of days, people will say that, well, I think one person says 60% of what you give to an aid organization just goes to the people running the organization, and somebody else said 90%. These figures just don't correspond to any reality, to any of the major organizations that you're likely to give to, whether it's CARE or World Vision or Children International or Oxfam America, a lot of organizations, or specific organizations that provide particular services, like organizations that help people who are blind to see again, perform operations with volunteer doctors, and organizations that operate on women who have a fistula, which is a terrible condition that ruins the lives of young girls and young women who have children sometimes because where their bodies are, perhaps they're too young to really cope with childbirth. So there are many bona fide organizations like this, and as I say, they're not hard to find, and I've listed some of them on the website I mentioned, thelifeyoucansave.com. So I don't think we should be put off by the occasional scandal that the newspapers might break about these organizations. Deborah, you mentioned also salaries. Well, sometimes it may be disturbing that the head of a large organization like this, which is helping the poor, is getting a salary that might be $150,000, $200,000, $250,000. That may seem somehow wrong when you're trying to help the poor. The problem is that it takes a very skilled person to run a large organization. If you have a large organization with a budget in many millions, in tens or even hundreds of millions, and you don't run it well, you can easily lose a few million here or a few million there through bad management. So you need skilled people. And the trouble is that you're competing with the corporate sector for these skilled people. Now, we've all been reading in the last few months how much people make on Wall Street if they choose to go into that, what kind of bonuses they're getting. They're not getting $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000. They're getting millions of dollars at the end of the year. So if you ask someone who has the skills that they could be earning millions of dollars on Wall Street or in some major corporation to work for an NGO and then say, but we're only going to pay you $50,000 because that's the average wage in America and we don't think that you ought to get more if you're working for this NGO, a lot of people are just going to turn you down. They're going to say, look, that's just too much of a sacrifice. I'm prepared to take less than I would get on Wall Street, but I'm not prepared to take that little. And so it's a bit of a dilemma. I wish that, if you like, people were more altruistic and they were prepared to all say, we're going to just work for the average wage, something like that. And there are some organizations that are like that, and I admire the people who do it, but it doesn't always work that way, and I think we just have to accept that if we want to maximize the good that the organizations do, sometimes we're going to have to pay people salaries that may seem a little steep.
Okay, now we're going to move a little bit from institutions to policies. So one question asks about population size, and you could think that simply aiding people while not giving people incentives not to have more children is a losing battle. You'll continually be doing this. So where does population fit in to your analysis? And another question relatedly asks about the environment and global climate change, and if that plays any role in your more recent thinking about combating poverty.
Yes. Well, certainly I'm glad the poverty issue, the population issue comes up, because that is an important question. I agree with those who say that the world's population cannot continue to grow indefinitely. We will run out of capacity to support population at a decent level. I think that some of the predictions made in the 1970s were a bit alarmist, and in fact the world has supported a larger population than some of those people writing then said it could support, and that's fortunate. But some countries have stabilised their population, or at least slowed their population growth, and that's very important. It's good that they've been successful in doing it. But there are certainly some countries where population is still growing quite rapidly, and is undermining the advances that you might otherwise make. So we do have to be aware of that, and we have to ask ourselves, what can we do to have an impact on this? Some of the things that we can do are things that we would do anyway if we're trying to reduce poverty. It's been shown that if a lot of children die, if there's a high rate of infant mortality, families will have more children. They want to make sure that they have children to provide for them in their old age, or to run the family farm, whatever it might be. So they have more to ensure that some will survive. And if you bring down the death rate, very often the fertility rate falls as well. Also, we want to educate people. Education is clearly a path out of poverty. And education is something that leads to smaller families. Particularly the education of girls is something that leads to smaller families. That's been quite well demonstrated. So we could help provide education for girls, and that would have an effect on reducing population. In some countries, we might still, even after that's done, we might still want to take more direct steps. We might want to work to provide the means of birth control, perhaps to provide condoms, especially if HIV is present in the area. Then condoms, of course, have a dual purpose. They protect us against the spread of disease, and they may reduce fertility. So I have no, you know, I'm not against doing that. When I talk about aid, I'm talking about aid in a very wide sense, and that will include anything that produces a long-term, sustainable route out of poverty for the people who are in poverty now and for their children and future generations. So the other question then was about climate change. Climate change has certainly been very much part of my thinking over the last few years. I wrote a book a few years ago, I think 2002 maybe, called One World, Ethics and Globalization. That has a chapter on climate change, in which I argue that we also have, you know, the climate change is also an ethical problem, and that the rich world is simply using too much of a scarce resource, the scarce resource being the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb our waste gases, and that that's a common resource shared by all of the world, but the rich nations have been using far more of it than the poor nations, and that is still true today. Let me perhaps nail one confusion on this topic. Some people say, look, China has now passed the United States as the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Yeah, it probably has in the last year or two. But don't forget, China has something like 1.2 billion people, and we have about 300 million. So their population is four times ours, and we're just about neck and neck in terms of greenhouse gases we're producing. I think that, you know, if you wanted to have a fair solution, the only fair solution would be that we have equal shares of the atmosphere, that everybody on Earth has an equal claim to the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb our waste gases. If that's so, then we are the ones who need to cut back. So that's part of the issue. As far as poverty is concerned, there's no doubt that climate change will be, perhaps already is, a factor in accelerating poverty in particular parts of the world. As I've said, I'm Australian. I've just recently come from Australia, the part of Australia where I live and grew up, southeastern Australia, the state of Victoria, is suffering what some people would call a drought, but what I really think is the consequences of climate change. If you look at rainfall over the last 10 years, it's not just a short-term drought, rainfall over the last 10 years is down 30 to 35% on average rainfall over the last century. And the result of that is that obviously it's much more difficult to farm in various ways. There isn't the water to produce crops that we have produced in the southern Australia, crops like rice and cotton that are very water intensive. Now, this is bad for Australia. It's bad for the farmers who live in the areas that used to farm with irrigation and no longer have the water to do it. But they're not starving, because Australia is still an affluent nation. We provide social security for them, we provide health care, we provide free education. But imagine when that happens in a country where there are none of those safety nets, none of that to fall back on. People are going to become refugees because of climate change, and we are really responsible for that. So I do think it's very relevant to the issue of poverty, and it's another part of the overall argument for why we ought to be doing something about it.
Okay, another group of questions deals with the question of motivation. So one of the questions asks whether or not we can have a duty that's generated in the absence of any firsthand experience of people who are poor or poverty. What is the basis of duty if it's not direct contact? A second question asks, as a philosopher would ask, how do you answer Hume's argument that reason alone cannot compel us to perform moral acts? So what do you say, in effect, to the moral skeptic who says, obligation, schmobligation, I have no moral obligation to do this, and you can't prove to me that I do? And then a third question along these lines says, does religion play a role in motivating people to aid those in need?
Okay, that's a good line of questions. Let me start maybe with Hume, since in a way that's perhaps the most basic. So for those of you who are not philosophers, we're talking here about David Hume, 18th century Scottish Enlightenment philosopher, and I must say one of the philosophers that I most admire. He's a beautiful writer, incidentally, as well as being a good thinker. So Hume has this argument that reason alone does not move us to action, that the only things that can move us to action are what he calls passions. He doesn't actually quite mean what we think of as passions. We tend to think of something pretty hot, I guess, when we talk about passion. you know, yes, I'm impassioned about that, because he talks about calm passions as well. So a calm passion is really just a desire that something should happen. But he thinks basically there have to be these kinds of desires or passions, whatever you want to call them, and that's always what is at the bottom of any kind of motivation. Reason alone does not move us to act. So reason can tell us about how to get what it is that we desire in the first place, can show us the means to the ends, or it can tell us that some of our desires maybe are a bit silly. So for instance, I have a phobia about spiders, let's say, so I see a spider up on the wall there, I immediately want to leave the room, right? Well, reason can tell me that that's pretty silly. The spider probably is not a kind of spider that would bite you at all anyway. Secondly, spiders don't, you know, leap off walls and attack you. So I should really just get over this, and reason can tell me about that, and maybe can, but I may still actually feel the phobia, some people do. So the question is, if Hume is right that everything comes back to this desire or passion, what am I to say to the person who says, look, I just don't care about people, the rest of the world, you know? There's variants on that. Maybe some people say, I don't care about anyone but myself. Some people will say, I don't care about anybody but myself and my family and my friends and a few people I love. Some people may say, I don't care about anyone except Americans, and so on. So how do you respond to that? Well, there's a lot of things that you can say. I don't think that I can deductively prove that, you know, that it's rational for you to do something about the world's poor if you don't care about them, and if you don't care about other things that are linked to them. So I'm not going to now, I mean, it's a big philosophical debate here, but I'm not going to now try and refute Hume on reason. That would, I think, be a little too ambitious. But I do think that, firstly, a lot of us actually have already a concern for others, and that concern for others gives us a motivation, gives us some sort of empathy for others to do something about it. And some people who don't have a concern for others might at least think in a broader way about their own interests. So even the person who says, well, I really just care about myself, I think ought to stop and think, well, what is it that is really going to make your life a good one? What is it that is really going to make your life a fulfilling one? And I think, you know, there's sort of ancient wisdom of philosophers who say that that those who set out to pursue pleasure often don't find it. And those who set out to pursue some other goal actually find pleasure in doing it. It's sometimes called the paradox of hedonism, that the best way to get pleasure is not to aim at it directly. I think often this goes along with our experience. You know, we do something that's just for the pleasure of it, and we think we're going to have a wonderful time. It ends up being a bit disappointing. Then we go and do something we think is worthwhile for some other sake, and we get involved in the task. We go with the flow. We form friendships through doing it, people that we respect because they're also doing this worthwhile thing, and it ends up being more rewarding than the thing that we just did for our own narrow self-interest. So I think that there's a lot of psychological research that supports that, that shows that people are happier if they give and work for others. And even, I have this in the book, a little bit of research where some researchers put people into an MRI machine, magnetic resonance imaging, that takes real-time images of their brain, shows which bits of their brain are active, and gave them opportunities to give something while they were doing this, and found that those that did give, actually the parts of the brain associated with pleasure, including parts that are activated during sex, actually lit up when they were giving as well. So I think we maybe, you know, people talk about that warm inner glow. Actually, you can see it going on in your brain when you do it. So I would say to the person who, you know, says, I'm only concerned about myself, well, maybe it, you know, even on that basis, we have an argument for why it's rational for you to give. Let me just say one more thing, because the question, before I leave Hume, I'm still on the first part of these three questions. The other thing that should be said is, if the question is, why do I think there's an obligation to give? Then I think you can say a bit more. What I was talking about now was what if somebody says, I don't care about moral obligation at all, I just care about myself. But if somebody says, I want to live ethically, I do want to think about ethics, then I think ethics has this element of putting yourself in the place of others. It's in a variety of religions, we'll get to the religion part of this issue later, but also in some secular ethics as well. That thinking ethically is putting yourself in the position of others and asking, you know, what you would want to happen in that situation. Well, if we do that, and if we do that imaginatively and empathetically, and we say, okay, so I put myself in the position of someone whose child could be saved by oral rehydration therapy for their diarrhea, and I put myself in the position of someone who has the capacity to give to an aid agency so that that aid agency will be able to make that treatment available in the village where that person is, but instead that person wants to buy a new pair of shoes. And I asked myself, well, if I had to live both of those lives, what would I want to happen? In other words, if I had to live both the life of the affluent person and the poor person, would I want the situation where the affluent person gets the shoes and the poor person's child dies? Or would I want the situation where the poor person's child lives and the affluent person has to make do with a cheap pair of shoes or wearing the same pair of shoes? Well, it's pretty obvious what the answer to that is. So I think that if you're prepared to follow this idea of putting yourself in the position of others, then that perhaps is enough to get the moral obligation going. That also relates to the second, or I think you said it first, part of the question, which was something like, well, if people don't have personal experience of poverty, you know, why do they have an obligation to do something about it? So I think I just answered that. It doesn't have to be a personal experience. It can be this kind of empathetic imagining of putting yourself in the position of others. And as long as you have the information and the knowledge to do that and to imagine what it's like, I think that you can see why there's that obligation. Finally, I come to religion. As I said, some of the great religions of the world have got onto this central element of ethics, that to live ethically is to put yourself in the position of others, to ask what would it be like for someone else, the golden rule, or the idea of loving your neighbour as yourself. Those are all ways of expressing this basic idea, and you find them not only in Judaism and Christianity, but in Islam and Hinduism and Confucianism and so on. But it doesn't have to be a religious insight, and I don't think we really need religion to derive this. In fact, those who say that you need to have belief in God in order to think that there really is such a thing as ethics face a well-known problem which goes right back to the ancient Greeks, to Plato, who in a dialogue called the Euthyphro has somebody say something like, the pious thing to do, we could take that as the ethical thing to do, is what the gods desire. And then Socrates is the character in the dialogue here, we don't know if the real Socrates said this, but the character in Plato's dialogue says, is what's good what the gods will, or do the gods will what they will because it's good? And when you think about it, it really doesn't make a lot of sense to say something is good only because the gods willed it, because then why would a god will that we help a poor child? Maybe a god would will that the poor child dies. Maybe a god would will that there be more cruelty in the world. In that case, creating cruelty would be a good thing on this view, if that was what the god willed. And you can't say, well, God wouldn't will that because it isn't good, because if you define good in terms of what God wills, there is no good that's sort of prior to God's will for you to really get that from. So I think whether you're religious or not, we still have this question about what's the basis of ethics, and it has to be something, I think, that is independent of belief in God.
Okay, another set of questions asks, what can we do if we don't have money? And I believe some of these questions come from the younger members of the audience who are looking for suggestions about ways to help but don't have money as a mechanism to help.
Right. Okay, well, the other thing that people may have, of course, is time. And some people are rich in money and poor in time, and some people are rich in time and poor in money. So you give what you have that you can spare. And then the question is, well, what can I do with my time? It's true that here often what you can do will be local rather than global. So it may be that although I've generally emphasized giving to the world's poor, it may be that you can make a contribution to that locally. If there are poor people in your community who you can help, you can work with some organization that's helping them, and that will give you a sense of what the issues are here, and will give you good experience, and you may really be able to make a good difference. But you can also, of course, try to work to spread awareness of the world's poor, which, as I was saying, we often don't have enough of in this country. And you can talk to organizations about whether there are ways in which you can volunteer or form a group in your high school or wherever you might be where you can study these issues, spread knowledge of them through the high school, maybe even hold fundraisers which can raise money for those events. You know, if you're part of a school band or something, and you can be put on a concert which will raise money, and who knows, it may be your path to fame and fortune. So you know, there's a lot of things that you can do, I think, if you have the time and the will, even without money.
Okay, this will be the last question, and this actually will make it a set of questions about how do you decide what organizations to give to, and particularly a question to you, if some organizations like Heifer International would conflict with some of your own values about animal rights, would you still give?
Right. Okay, so the answer to the first part is I want to give where my my dollars will do the most good. Okay, like everyone here, even like Bill Gates, I have a finite amount of money I can give. The amounts will vary a lot, but they're always finite. So I want to do as much good as I can with them. I want to help the most people. Maybe you could say, you know, some you might want to focus on saving lives of the children I mentioned, or you might want to focus on helping people to live a life that is not, you know, totally without the minimal kind of decency that we think befitting a human existence. So I'm looking for organizations that are doing that in an effective way. And of course you can't demonstrate exactly what organizations are doing, but you can try and assess them and measure them in various ways. I've had a long relationship with Oxfam in three different countries now, in Britain, where I first started getting interested in this issue, as I said, where I was a graduate student back in 1971 at Oxford. Then back in Australia with Oxfam Australia, and now in the US with Oxfam America. I like all of these organizations because, I mean, they're actually independent organizations, so they work together and cooperate in the regions they work in. But they all, I think, have this idea that as well as doing the grassroots work for the poor, they serve as advocacy organizations for the poor. So they're prepared to get out there and, for example, criticize the agricultural subsidies that we pay in this country, which deprive some poor farmers of international markets, because although they actually produce, say, cotton more cheaply than our cotton growers, US cotton is so heavily subsidized that the US cotton growers can sell it on the world markets more cheaply than small peasant farmers in West Africa. So, you know, I like that about Oxfam. I like the sort of, the people I've met have, you know, really been committed, dedicated people, and I've met a lot of the field officers who work in the field, and I think they know a lot about it. They're realistic and they're effective. But there is also an organization that I want to mention which actually does some of this work of trying to assess organizations for their effectiveness. It's called GiveWell, and you find it on the web at givewell.net. There is some other organization, I think, called givewell.org, but this is givewell.net. And they have been, they're only a young organization, but they are trying to get data and information and encourage organizations to do more evaluation, more assessment, so that you can find the most effective organizations. And I've actually been supporting them as well, even though they're not directly an aid organization, because I think they're having a beneficial effect on getting the aid organizations to demonstrate their effectiveness. And I think that's important for the future of the aid industry. Then the very last question was, what do I do about organizations that maybe conflict with some of my objectives? And you mentioned Heifer International, which provides people with cows or goats or other animals. Look, let me say that although I'm a vegetarian, I don't eat animals, and I do support broadly animal rights objectives, I'm not against people keeping animals if that's the only way that they can feed themselves and their families. If they cannot get a balanced diet without some animal food, you know, then I accept that that's what they have to do. We're very lucky. We can walk into a supermarket and we find a huge variety of foods that don't involve animal products, and we can get easily the sort of things that we need to nourish ourselves there. Not everybody in the world can do that. So as long as these animals are well looked after, you know, they maybe end up being killed, but as long as they have reasonable lives, I don't really object to that. I would object if organizations were setting up factory farms which confine animals indoors and give them, I think, totally miserable lives. And anyway, that tends to be pretty wasteful of grain, because you have to feed them on grain then, which you could eat more directly, rather than feeding it to the animal and wasting a lot of the food value before you eat the animal product. So there would be some organizations, if they were doing that, I don't know that they are, that I would not support. Otherwise, I would still ask, you know, is this an effective way of ending world poverty? When I donate to Oxfam, incidentally, you can pick and choose the particular project that you want to donate to if you ask them. You can, of course, just send them funds for general support and they will decide. But if you say, I'd like to know what projects you're supporting, and I'd like to allocate my funds to that project, you can do that. So I do that, and in fact I do choose projects that don't involve animals, and for that reason there's no conflict.
So unfortunately, we're out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I want to thank Peter for doing exactly what he did, which is provide stimulating and interesting talk on a matter of urgent public concern. And I hope that you'll all continue the conversation to see the ways that global justice isn't simply an abstraction, and that Peter has agreed generously to stay and sign copies of his book, and I encourage you to stay and buy his book and talk to him, and also to check out the website of the book that he mentioned. Thank you.